us this morning. I really appreciate your dedication in coming to learn about building our nation and the kinds of things that would be necessary to do that. So this afternoon, we welcome you to what we call Constitution 101. So it's just a basic introductory. Hopefully, after reading and getting this information, you know, you look for other sources to educate yourself in what a constitution normally looks like. So, in a few months, as you all know, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, with other Hawaiian organizations, will likely be hosting a constitutional convention. So we wanted to get our people prepared to participate in that, and that's the purpose of this workshop. We're going to go over elements of the Hawaiian Kingdom Constitution so that you can see what those constitutions consisted of. And I'm going to go over every single one. We gave you copies of all of the constitutions. And then after we're done with that, we're going to cook up a bit about what an indigenous constitution might look like. What would our Native Hawaiian self-governing look like? We are not suggesting what the Constitution should consist of, but rather to cause us to become more educated or knowledgeable about what goes into constitutions. So today, in this workshop, we have two speakers. One is Alan Murakami, who's on my right. I think many of you know Alan. He was a longtime litigation director for the for the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. And sometimes you have friends, and what are friends for but to use them, right? So I call him up. And I say, please, Alan, would you please do this? Because Native Hawaiian Legal Corps, actually, several years ago, as part of Huina Awau, some of you will remember Huina Awau, who did nation-building training, they actually had put together a package on this. And one of the old-timers sent me that package. And so I sent it to Moses Haya and to Alan, and I asked them if they would please try to do this for us again. And so thank you, Mahalo, Alan, for being with us. And then the second person, not unfamiliar to many of us, and a longtime Civic Club member of Hawaiian Civic Club of Honolulu, and also the former CEO for the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation, is Mahea Lani Wendt. And so she will actually be facilitating this workshop, and in the end, help us to look through the Paukalani Declaration, because that declaration has a lot of viewpoints from the viewpoint of the Native Hawaiian. It was developed, I'm trying to remember, I think it was in 1996, and I happened to be at that convention, and in my archives, pulled out that paper, and we thought, this is a good resource document for all of us. So they're going to lead us in the discussions. Mahialani is going to start with definition of constitution, constitutional convention, the elements of the constitution, so that we kind of all have that basic understanding first before Alan starts. So please help me to welcome the both of them, and with a nice round of applause. And to thank Primo, who was drafted to help with the slides a few minutes ago. And if folks don't mind, Blaine Bergstra is proper to film some of this, but we are limited by the gallery. So if the gallery only allows 10 minutes, that's all I ever really record. But we are trying to record also. Our intent was if we could record this or tape it, then maybe we could make it accessible to others for educational purposes. But the other thing is, if you like it, when you fill out your critique, most of you, not only, are Civic Club members. Do you think this is worthy to do again? out in the community, please say that, because then we can influence the board of directors to take this kind of training out to all of our city club members and various councils and clubs. Okay, so
in our local meeting, thanks for taking part in your busy schedule. Thank you. Okay, I'm not going to be able to stay because I have to go to the board meeting. So I'm going to stay for a while, but as I say, Monica and Lennon will facilitate our workshop and our discussions. Mahalo.
Thank you, Mom. First, I want to mahalo on the association of the Hakeem Broken Junction. And it just happened yesterday. And we've always been lucky on that we were pleased with all the pamapama that folks have handled on. So, can we have a hand for him? He's such a trooper. And also, does everybody have a set of handouts? Does this belong to anyone here? He's left behind, maybe by someone else. So welcome everyone. Very, very nice to be here. I will be facilitating this workshop, and Alan actually will be the lead presenter. I wanted to especially point out the, one of the handouts, the Power Economy Declaration, which was actually put together in 2002. And it's really, really important because none of us are forced or prescribed to do anything that anybody else did as far as how we want the nation to be. It's up to us, and it has to come from us. And how we understand people, our culture, it has to be truly responsive to who we are as a people and nobody else. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and all of those folks who wrote the Declaration of Independence and were authors of the U.S. Constitution, but that's not us, that's them. So, the Manawa really is the thing, the sky's the limit, and what we have to do, what our big job is, as a people, is to really listen to the voices of our Kuna and our people as we put together a way of organizing ourselves politically that truly reflects who we are as a people. So with that, I just want to reassure you that I have asked God for His blessings on all of us today as we deliver and make our peace representations.
I just wanted to
read some words of inspiration from Joseph Navarino, Colombia. I went forward with determination. I fought with courage. I achieved victory for the benefit of the people for whom I humbly served. I prepared fearlessly for the tasks that lay before me. And if any of you or all of you decide when the time comes to go forward and become a delegate to putting together a governance document that we might call the Constitution. These are the words that I think we should keep in mind and be inspired by. To be paha, to be formal, and to do it selflessly for our people. May I have the next one? So this is a basic definition of a constitution, a body of fundamental principles or established precedents according to which a state or other organization is acknowledged to be governing. basic law of government. And by the way, I think every one of us is competent to participate in the drafting of our constitution. Every single one of us is competent to do this work. A constitutional convention, a duly constituted assembly of delegates or representatives of the people of a state or nation for the purpose of framing, revising, or amending its constitution. Oh, okay, I guess you should. Fundamental principles or Bill of Rights, we see these enshrined in the first Dominican Constitution. Certain fundamental things that we really take for granted under this system, freedom of speech, the right to gather, freedom of assembly, freedom against discrimination on the basis of one's race, all of those, the pursuit of happiness, all of these are fundamental principles that are aspirational, are things that we dream, the ideal situation. These are what are included in our fundamental principles. And when you look at the Paulo Coelho Declaration, you will see that in 2002, our people gathered and they together collaborated and came to an agreement of what those principles could be. That was 2003. Perhaps those principles are still valid and relevant for us today. Citizenship. This is a really, really important component of a governance document, because there's been a lot of discussion over whether, when we form our government, it should be Kanaka Maoli, exclusive to Kanaka Maoli, or whether it should be included to other citizens. At the present time, there's a registration that is limited to those of Kanaka ancestry and nationality. It's a process that's being initiated by Hawaiians, but when you get to a constitutional convention, the delegates to that convention have a right to consider, reconsider that, who shall be citizens, and this certainly might include Kanaka or those who are not necessarily of Hawaiian or ancestry, for example. You might want to include those who are descendants of those who were citizens of the kingdom at the time of the overthrow, or who had demonstrated their loyalty to the RLE of the kingdom at that time. This is, the idea of citizenship is completely at the discretion of the delegates of the kingdom. So it's not whatever government we form, it's entirely up to the delegates to decide and consider that question. Yes. Organizational structure and parts of government. Now, this is really an important thing, because we're kind of used to this model where there's three branches of government, and each of these branches exercise certain powers. The executive branch, which is headed by the president, executes the laws. The legislative, or what we know as Congress, makes the laws, and the judicial branch interprets those laws. When we have a chiefly system, all of these powers were consolidated in one. He made the law, he executed the law, and he was the judge and jury as well. So again, when you consider your constitution, is this separation of powers a good way to proceed? That is the model that we're most familiar with, but is that the way we would like to, constitute our own government? Because of our traditions and our values, we may want to go at another way. And in Kalaalii Hawaii had a democratic form, but they also had an elite branch. that was advisory to the head of KIU. So all options are open. Nothing is foreclosed, and you need to be very open-minded. The other thing is, we had a constitutional monarchy at the time in 1893 when our government was usurped. Is this, many say that we should begin the conversation with respect to constituting our new government at that point where we left off in 1893. Begin with that constitution and make the amendments necessary to bring it forward so that there is continuity, that there is tacit acknowledgement that our sovereignty still exists, that it's unbroken from that time to this. So these are the kinds of conversations that our delegates will certainly have when they get together to consider a constitution. Next slide. Procedural, how government should proceed. I noticed Amomi Pandey, who knows, she included things like the sort of the nuts and bolts ways that government operates, including taxation, health services, welfare services, housing, all of the things that governments, all of the duties that governments perform, public works, all of these things under the procedure of how government operates. And revision and amendment, in our Hawaii Constitution, if the voters agree, we can convene every 10 years to reconsider the provisions of the Constitution. You know, it's very interesting that in 1978, which was when our last state constitutional convention was held, there was really a landmark con, because that's the by amendment to the Constitution, the Office of Foreign Affairs was created. By amendment to the Constitution, Hawaiian language was made officially a language of the state body. By amendment to the Constitution, certain traditional and customary rights were defined in the Constitution. The other thing in our public sector employees, collective bargaining was included by amendment to the Constitution. So, those segments of our community who had benefited from those amendments to the Constitution are not necessarily that receptive to the idea of having another constitutional convention, because they're concerned that there will be amendments to eliminate all of those rights. So that's a very interesting discussion. I think traditionally the Office of Foreign Affairs has resisted the convening of another compound for that reason. They are concerned that the work is not yet done, and because of misinformation or misunderstandings in the community, our people are a minority in our opinion that others may eliminate by an amendment. So, revision and amendment to the Constitution is always possible, but at least in the state of Hawaii, the voters have to agree that they want to convene this kankan. And so far, from 1978 to this day, there has not been another convention to take a look at amending the Constitution. Finalization of constitution ratification. After the delegates have drafted what they believe is a good proposal for our people, the people have to approve it. So it's not up to the delegates. It's up to the delegates to make a proposal, to work really hard to make a proposal. But that proposal must go before the people for their approval. And this will be done in a referendum. If the people approve, then that will be the constitution, and now it will be implemented. If you have created a prime minister position, then we will elect the prime minister and all of the officers and representatives that the constitution calls for. If the people do not approve the constitution, then it goes back to the drawing board until a constitution is ratified, the approval is called ratification. And so I just thought over these components of the constitution. And I guess that's it. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mana Laura Kami to talk about our kingdom constitution. Okay, so while they're setting up, what I've done is made it hard for you to read this so you come to the front of the room. So I don't know how good your eyes are, but mine would not be able to see this. But what I just basically try to do is, the Constitution's over, basically four versions and one draft are both remarkably similar and also very dramatically different in parts where history and politics intervene in Hawaii's history. And so what I basically try to do is try to see how it evolved over time and see what kind of commonalities there were as well as differences. And certainly at the very beginning with the 1840 Constitution, which was an attempt to codify the will of Kamehameha I, there were a lot of kind of broad principles about, protecting the rights of the people and having government be responsive to that. But as the subsequent three versions of the Constitution evolved, you can see a very heavy influence of the Christian religion and Jehovah appears in the Constitution. So you can see that there's been a lot of influence about Christian heritage in these original constitutions. I have versions basically for 1840, 1852, 1874, 1887, the infamous Dan Constitution, and 1893. I didn't fill in all the blanks, but try to capture the stuff in there that seemed to be most prevalent and instructive for people who were trying to get into a constitutional convention kind of exercise. But clearly you can see that these early articles with the subsequent constitution of 1840 that there was a lot of reference to God and following God's will and that kind of thing. And yet, if you go down to this further provisions of the Constitution, you see there is recognition of certain fundamental rights that, in a way, both complement and, in a way, I think, contradict that notion.
Is that where you want to be?
Maybe
the next page is going to be relevant.
Just go down to page six. Page two, the next page two, yeah. Slide over to page two. Go on the next page. Yeah, there. Okay, so there is a clear right of free speech that pops up in there. I guess this is a heavily influence of the American population presence in the kingdom. And explicit recognition is in the Constitution is pretty consistent to recognize the freedom to speak out, and the one before that slide or that page, freedom to worship. So you have both the recognition of the Christian heritage, and you have this attempt to have a freedom of religious practice instituted in the Constitution as well. Although there, it is a reference not to necessarily to a strict form of freedom of religion, as it is a right to freely interpret God's will. So, no one's an atheist here. Next page, you can see again heavy with it. With the influence of the American Constitution, the right to assemble and the right to habeas corpus, to be free of any kind of arbitrary incarceration without charge.
further down, the right to conviction by a proper court, so you can't just arbitrarily held. So there is habeas corpus, but also a positive and affirmative right to be charged and told the charge, and a right to a jury trial. So all those things are very important to consider in formulating any constitution. Further down on page 5, you'll see also famously the freedom of having double jeopardy. In other words, if you get convicted of a crime one time, you can't be convicted of the same crime again. I think a lot of us are familiar with that. That appears in the Illinois Constitution pretty consistently. There's also an explicit recognition that they can't force you to testify against yourself, and implicit recognition that there shouldn't be any torture. Further down on the next page, recognition of freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, something that we find in our own U.S. Constitution, the Fourth Amendment. After that, there's protection for people generally. I think this is an attempt to have a government be the good guy, protect the common person, not be arbitrary and try to favor the chiefs or higher grand rulers. And that's an algorithm of the former 1840 Constitution stated slightly differently. Then we get into the recognition under this list of civil rights, the ability to basically enjoy life, liberty, and property, and to defend against the loss of it. Stated in a slightly different way than what you're familiar with. Going down to page 8, you see here basic notions about governance, how the government can tax and appropriate money for the public good, etc. Going down to page 9, you see a lot of common provisions about respecting or prohibiting laws that are basically unjust, such as what they call ex post facto law, trying to pass laws that have retroactive effect. That appears pretty consistently throughout Article 16 or 17, depending on the Constitution's version. And the right to form a military. If you can skip down there to page 11, where there's an explicit recognition of the constitutional form of government under Articles 21 and 22, approximately the same number in the various constitutions. And so there's basically explicit recognition that the king is important, that the monarchy is basically recognized. And really interestingly, in the 1887 B&M Constitution, an affirmation of that, although as you see, there's extreme restrictions on the power of the king to exercise his powers because of the House of Nobles. On page 12 here, we have.
Can we ask questions?
Sure. If you wanted to ask questions, that would be fine too.
When did those restrictions come in? Under
1887, the B&M Constitution. The question was, when did those restrictions come through? And basically, I was saying that it started with the assertion of power by a lot of American businessmen in 1887. There was an insurrection that was basically quelled by forcing the king to adopt this constitution that enhanced the power of the House of Nobles, which is a very restricted body, which you can only qualify by way of the size of your assets and the level of your income. Somebody back there?
Yeah, what did any of those constitutions were ratified?
Basically, they were all ratified except for the 1893 Constitution, which only we attempted to get it ratified, and that was blocked because of the overthrow. So, let's see. I'm going to skip over some of these because they seem to be pretty common throughout.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
You talk about God's love, you talk about the Bible.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of as in terms of a historical reason for that reference. But I would have to say yes, because there wasn't much else around going on at the time historically. But it doesn't say a Christian God or anything like that. There is a reference to Jehovah, which I guess could be a reference to various types of Christianity. But in essence, Christian, yes. The provisions about succession to the throne, I'm going to skip over that. Pretty much go down to, I think it's in the same page 17 on that.
17?
Yeah.
Page 17. Page 17. 43?
Yeah, you want to go further down. In the 1852 Constitution, there was the appearance of what's known as Tutankhamun, which doesn't appear in any other version. And I'm not one to prepare to talk about what exactly that is culturally, but it's the only appearance that I noticed in all the various versions of the constitutions that put up there. Well, it gets us
40.
But on the, let's put it down there.
Which article?
43 of the second law.
It's there. It ended.
Okay, so you're past it.
Yeah.
Well, it's on my page 17.
Okay.
So I come to the point there now about the 1887 Constitution, because although there was a reaffirmation of the monarchy in the Constitution as with the prior versions, because of the circumstances where the American businessmen were desirous of getting control of basically certain benefits economically, and the king was basically getting in the way. There was a successful attempt for a period of time to get instituted a very heightened power block in what's known as the House of Nobles. And what had been basically a body that was sitting with what was a House of Representatives elected by everybody as a representative body of the population. The House of Nobles became this elite body that could only be elected into office by a very small select electorate, which was qualified by property. How much property you owned and how much income you had per year. That chart does not seem to appear because I have it highlighted in yellow. Do you see that? Okay. So why don't we go on to the second document. Can you pull that up?
Oh. Okay. Second document.
He wants the other
second document.
There are other features of the these constitutions that had a lot in common. One of them was the some of the advisory bodies to the king being the Privy Council, and that seems to appear also pretty consistently through the various forms of the constitution. But in the 1887 constitution that was in turn the Bayonet Constitution, here's where you have a real explicit, pretty notorious attempt to change and basically a more democratically controlled constitutional monarch to something that is going to be run by a more autocratic form of government because of the rise of the House of Lords. And what the constitution provided there was that this group of nobles would come from select districts and could only be elected by people who had, as you see in yellow, certain assets that are pretty hard to achieve. In this instance, you have to have $3,000 of assets and $600 per year of income. Now, that's pretty hard for us to relate today, but this was a pretty enormous burden to overcome because most people was ignoring and was running nowhere near that amount. No one held that much property. And so basically, the nobles who had to approve whatever the king did then had this distinct power as a small group of entitled business people, basically, to be able to override key decisions of the monarch. And it also sat as a court, in a sense, to judge the qualifications of appointed officials, including the legislative body when there's charges of misconduct. So it had an immense influence in the ultimate power of the monarchy to achieve anything. And if you do a comparison with some of what was instituted before and what was proposed after, you can see that if you go down to the 1893 Constitution draft, what the Queen proposed at that point was to not get rid of the House of Nobles, but make it an appointed body, rather than elected by an elite group of basically prosperous individuals. She proposed to make it appointed. Although she provided for a House of Representatives that would be elected, the qualifications for the voter there was much lower, because you can see here that the asset requirement was only $150, so quite a bit less than the $3,000 required for the nobles, and or rent being paid of $25 a year, and income of no less than $75 per year, rather than I believe it was $600. So quite a big disparity in terms of the democratization of at least the elected body, the House of Representatives, and basically the relegating of the House of Nobles, which had been pretty much an autocracy, to being just a appointed body to advise the king. So these are some of the things to think about in terms of like what the history provided for precedence in a constitution. But I also noted what was missing in these constitutions that may be something maybe more thought provoking today, even our contemporary society. There was not an equal protection clause. There was no bar against racial, sexual, religious discrimination. So that's something to really think about. I mean, it's, I think, something that would be more important today, perhaps back then, maybe not. But it was something that seemed to escape at least the drafters of the constitutions of that time. But should be something that should be of some concern to you today. There is a due process clause in there, but I raise that because it's important, because those two clauses, or those two amendments in the Constitution, have been very instrumental in our own development legally in the United States, and could be something of great importance as the new nation arises in its own constitution. So those are some of the highlights, I guess, at this point. I'm just wondering if anybody here has any burning questions about any other provisions that might have caught their attention in your own research. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question. Was the 14th Amendment drafted at the time of this 1897?
Yes.
It was?
Yes. 1863, I believe.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, there are laws against slavery and involuntary servitude in this Constitution that came up in the 1864 Constitution. I think because of the influence of the Civil War.
Okay, what year was the 14th Amendment passed?
I believe it was 1867, not long after the end of the Civil War. Might have been a little bit later, I'm not exactly sure.
I think we have to also be cognizant of what provisions come under what constitution. There's going to be two versions of which one wins out. Because if one version wins out, then the U.S. Constitution still holds weight. Whereas if the total sovereignty wins out, then it's free for all at that point. Would that be correct?
Well, you're speaking of under the assumption that there is a, or lack of better terminology, a nation within nation model.
No, there's two versions right now, right? That's vying for Constitution Act.
You're referring to the Constitution that came out of the Obama-Obama.
Well, no, the two points of views that are saying we want this type of sovereignty versus we want this type of sovereignty. And if you have one version that's if you take one version, it has to be under the Constitution of the U.S. and Congress and that. Or if the other one, then you have this, whatever you want, would that be correct?
I think that's a discussion. Because this morning you had some presenters talking about rights under nation within a nation, a federal recognition approach, as opposed to an independence model. And certain rights were excluded if you, or it was presented in the sense that certain rights are excluded, for example, the right to enter into treaties with foreign governments are excluded under a nation within a nation model. But I'll give you my own perspective. I believe that when our delegates convene, they need to be mindful of what our people, or be responsive to what our people believe is best for our people. Irrespective of where that might be internationally or independently. So for, you know, I should disclose that I'm the Vietnam Road Commission, and we have consistently said that our government should be constituted so it can be recognized and have a formal relationship with governments, whoever those governments may be, state, federal, international. So the Constitution has to come first, and then the people have to decide which governments they want to enter into a formal relationship with.
Yeah, I would only add that I think the three explicit areas where you have certain powers in the international independence mode versus a nation in the nation mode is going to be the making of treaties and external foreign affairs, the raising of a military, and then dealing with immigration. I mean, these are kind of fundamental powers that a purely independent government would probably want to address in the Constitution. But Mahia's right. People that are affected should determine what they want first and then let the foreign government achieve that end rather than, you know, assuming something and thinking that that's what's going to drive their constitution.
I mentioned to you earlier about the Constitution workshop that was presented about 15 years ago, so I'm thinking, is the process we're going to have this convention, and then we have this convention and we write a constitution, right? And if we write this constitution and we draft a constitution, and then we decide, as an example, that we want to be a government to government. At that point, Does the United States, do they require that Constitution be written, that we report to the Secretary of Interior? Because at this workshop that I attended, they gave us a copy of the American Samoan Constitution in which Samoa reports to the Secretary of Interior, and it was recommended that we do not want to report to the Secretary of Interior. So I'm just thinking about this process. When does this come up?
The recent DOI hearings, they were asking for input from us as to whether what we wanted to do. So at the current time, the rules and regulations under Interior provide that any indigenous nations within these so-called territories fall under the Department of Interior. So that would be the option. Now, for me, it implicates this other idea, which is the idea of a referendum, whether it comes before or after we draft our constitution. In other words, should we put before our people the question of nation or federal recognition or independence before we even go to have our constitutional convention, have a referendum, have that question decided, and then draft our constitution? Or should we draft the constitution and then decide whether we wish to enter into a political relationship with the United States or other governments? So, I mean, I favor having a referendum prior, or I support it, but either way.
Reporting to the Secretary of Interior at our session earlier this morning, it seemed to be quite an issue about us with the Secretary of Interior, how much control they have, or mismanagement, or whatever. Do we keep this at top of mind?
The Constitution comes first, and then the people decide whether, given that Constitution, we wish to, at that time, enter into a political relationship with the United States. Now, the United States may say, we do not like your Constitution. We believe your Constitution should provide, for example, equal protection. We don't know what our delegates are going to decide, but it's a possibility. They say, well, we understand that you wish to enter into a political, formal relationship with us, but we do not like this provision in your constitution, or you fail to address discrimination in your constitution, certainly. So at that time, it's up to the people to decide whether they want to enter into a relationship.
I'm still confused. You said a nation within the nation. Is that similar to what the Native Americans have done?
Yes.
Because then they report to the Secretary of the Interior.
That's what it is. Right. Yes.
So then you don't have the Constitution.
The only thing you have, the Native nations do have constitutions. They all have constitutions. So what I'm saying is that recognition of Native nations within the claimed territories of the United States are only through the Secretary of Interior at this time. And that offends a lot of our people because they believe, especially since we have been or still are an independent nation, it's not the Interior. That's why they're saying, that's why the letter was addressed to John Kerry, Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is the point person for international relationships. And so the letter that Kamala Harris sent was addressed to the Secretary of State.
So would it be more productive that you become a sovereign nation within a nation after you got the recognition, then go for the international part?
That's for the delegates to decide. Some people believe what we just described. Okay.
And the other side is just totally an independent nation.
Yeah, we totally agree.
Any other questions?
Yes.
So I would like to try to clarify this. I want to do it this way because I'll tell you what, this gets very complicated. And for me,
I spent a lot of time trying to review. I listened to everybody enough, and then I got to figure it out in terms of what I can understand. So this morning I used an example. All of you belong to a civic club. When your civic club was formed, you had to write the constitution and bylaws. You wrote what you believed, what you believed your club's mission would be, what your values would be, and you set up your views on how often you might hold elections, who your officers would be, etc. Right? Remember, you did all of that. And then you had to submit it to the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs in order to be chartered. When you submit it, the association has its rules. It follows its our constitution and bylaws. So if they look at your club's constitution and bylaws and they say, Aole, this club isn't doing this, 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 the association will not charter you. They will go back and they will say, your constitution or your bylaws miss these points. Please reconsider. And then you go back and you look at it, and if you still want the association to recognize you, you fix your bylaws. Okay, so let me liken that to what we're doing now as a people, what we're doing now. We write our constitution. What is it that we want in governance? How do we want to organize our government? How do we want it to operate? When we as a people decide that, and we put that all out in the Constitution, just as our Ali'i did, they had constitutions, right, for self-governance. Okay, so we get together, we put that all down, we then send it out to our people to ratify, because our people have to all agree, not just the delegates. The delegates are the working group. They pulled this all together for us. So now we're going to vote on it. And let's say that we all like the work of the delegates, so we approve the Constitution. That's the governing document. The next step is we have to implement that Constitution. So what does implementation mean? Well, in our Constitution, we would have set forth the powers of the offices. So we may say, in our governance, we might have a kuhina nui. Okay, or, I don't know how you say governor in Hawaiian, but kia'aina, okay? So we may say we want a kia'aina, we want, let's see, we want a Hawaii council of delegates, we want a Kauai council, and so on and so on. Okay, so in other words, this is like our House of Representatives. We might decide that in our constitution. So now we've got to implement. We've got to elect all those people. We have to elect our government officials. Okay, now we've done all that. Sounds pretty good so far. Now we've got to decide, who do we want to recognize us? Do we want to go for a federal recognition, or what? Let's start with state first. Do we want to go to the state of Hawaii and ask the state of Hawaii to recognize our governing entity so we can be at the table to start to negotiate? We might negotiate on education issues. We might negotiate on health issues. We might negotiate, when we talk about education, for example, we might negotiate on funding that we need for our Hawaiian schools. But we have an entity now who can talk with the legislature, who can be at the table to do this kukapi ha. We have to get the state to recognize us. The state probably has its laws and rules and whatnot. And so they'll look at our constitution and our bylaws, and if it looks like it's all okay, they might say, yeah, we're going to recognize your governing entity. We will go to the table with you. Or we may say, no, we want to skip that. We want federal recognition. So the process right now is when you file for federal recognition, and we file it with the Department of Interior, because that's how the U.S. government has established that process. So we go to them, and we say, we want federal recognition. And they come back and they tell us, yeah, you know, everything looks good, but oh, by the way, in your constitution or bylaws, you have to recognize that you're going to come under us. We as a people may say, no, we're not going under you. We don't want that thing. So we skip that, right? My good so far. Okay. So we skip that and we say, well then, to be honest, for you, we're going to go see international recognition. And we go that process and we try to get that recognized. And at the international level, again, they have their rules. They look at our governing entity, our constitution, our governing documents, and they may say, yes, we will recognize you. Now, there's a lot of work in all of those steps, and I will tell you that I'm not a lawyer. That's why on some of these things, we turn to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs with the questions because they have legal people on staff. We don't. Okay. But, you know, Ahilani also mentioned another process. Okay, so let me tell you what that is. So we kind of have two choices. One is we go have a constitutional convention now, which means we elect our delegates, get the delegates together. So we heard the great debate as it's referred. So all kinds of people, whoever we elect, they go to the table, they hash this all out, they give us a document, we ratify it. That's one way. The other way, before we even get to that, is for us to have a referendum where we all decide which form of government would we really like. I mean, no, who do we want to recognize us? Okay, so on this political referendum ballot might be independence or international recognition, federal recognition, which is also known as nation within a nation. There's other forms of governance, I forget what they are now. But, so you have that all down. So now we go vote. This half of the room may decide we want international recognition. This side of the room might say we want federal recognition. But look at the numbers on this side, right? We have more numbers on this side than this side. So the decision is going to be made by the people by majority vote that we're going to go for international recognition. Now, we have the Constitutional Convention, and that Convention of Delegates would now build the governing document with the outcome that we would get international recognition, that we would meet the requirements for international recognition. Okay, so I'm hoping, you know, I'm trying to explain this, that if you're like me, that's kind of like a bottom line. But within all of that, there's a lot of legal stuff. I mean, you know, there's this Saturday, there are some people coming from Washington, D.C., who are experts in international recognition and federal recognition. I think you folks have read that in the newspaper. OHA is sponsoring that educational forum, right? You familiar with that? Okay. So these guys are going to come in to try to explain all of that to us. And I was looking at the questions that Mataina Na had posed through the internet on SurveyMonkey for OHA to consider to ask these experts. And if you read it, it will bog your mind because it's got real technical stuff. And for me, I'm just a Mataina. I want simple, just explain to me in simple terms what this means. So I hope I try to, you know, help to bring clarity into where we are.
I have a question, Alan. Our Hawaiian Constitution back of 1840s, it took it directly to, they had so much manpower as a government that it went directly into a relationship with other countries via treaties. Now we're talking about recognition, but we're not talking treaties with the Constitution that is a carryover in that type of Constitution, and then definitely directly into treaties with many countries. Do we have that? Will we have that kind of same mechanism where we can talk treaties and not?
If you go into this.
Well, yeah, I think, as Maya said earlier, the likelihood of interior accepting that notion that the Constitution can we recognize that we allow a Hawaiian nation to have military, have international relations, ability to make treaties with different countries that are in the international community of nations now is not likely. But the question then becomes, in a way, if that's what people want, so what? Michelle pointed to the example of Lakota. You are a domestic dependent nation under the Constitution under the the Department of Interior Standards, because of the Nuclear Act. You're an Indian reorganization, I think, before. But they're going to the UN to get specific international recognition. The Seminole tribe in Florida never established an Indian Reorganization Act constitution. And they consider themselves, you know, still independent, but and never resolved formal recognition. I hear a lot of people who say, if you're sovereign, that's what it is. It's not dictated by what entity recognizes you. So what is the bottom line, as I'm only saying, is what is the will of the people? Because when you develop that, whether you do it through an initial referendum or a constitutional convention, as far as that can do, hopefully, I guess in June or something, next year.
They're funded,
they're facilitated, but you have to have basically a reflection of the will of the people being governed first. And then I think you figure out where you go from there, whether it's this door number one, two, or three. And as attractive as a lot of these arguments are for independence, I think there's a lot of considerations there that people are kind of easily overlooking about other people's concerns about what that might mean. And, you know, that's the first step that has been taken there. And what's frustrating is to see 30 years go by where I've seen about two or three attempts to do exactly what was proposed to do next year, get thwarted by Hawaiians because they feel it's not the right way to go. We've got to go through independence first, and we don't do that in the spirit sense, then everything else is compromised, which I don't think is a naturally rational position to take.
I think Alan is giving an evidence of this discussion should be based on the convention. All of us have a Manao. The Manao that was publicly expressed overwhelmingly at the hearing should be represented at a constitutional convention. And so should the Manao of those who did not want to get in front of people and yell at me. Not everybody. I mean, a lot of our testifiers were very dignified. A lot of them were very emotionally overwrought. All of that should come and be represented at a convention. And that is where the decision needs to be made. I don't think what happened as a result of the DOI hearings that our quest for sovereignty has been thwarted at all. So,
the Constitutional Convention that was funding June 2015, if the people want to do the referendum first before the Constitution, how do we do that?
We have my understanding is that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is constituting a consortium of groups who will oversee the process. So it's not a foregone conclusion that it's actually going to be the way you're describing. So this process typically would include an election of delegates on drafting of a constitution and ratification of that. But it is really up to those who are members of this consortium to recommend the process, which may include or not include a referendum. So the
constituent groups of that consortium in the present time, and it's not filed yet, is my understanding, it would be wine wholesalers, the city clubs, possibly the Council of Native Hawaiian Clansmen. The under consideration is the Native Hawaiian Bar Association and other groups. And so these groups supposedly are good representation of a broad section of our community. So they need to consult with our people and get manawa about what is the best way to proceed. So it's not all, it's not decided.
Just had a simple question about the date that was chosen for the convention. That particular date chosen based on the census of all of the tribes as a whole, or that chosen by OHA?
It was OHA, and the consideration was some people from the community as well as their fiscal limitations. A budget runs from July 1st of 1 year to June 30th of the following year. So those kinds of considerations. We have a trustee. Is that you, Oz? That's you, right? So Trustee Stender is here, and he can address your questions. OHA has been very generous in their willingness to fund this process, at least so far. Thank you, Justine.
This one's here?
Oh, very beautiful. Yeah, the authors are attending again. I guess the effort is to get the Hawaiians get together and come by majority rule. I guess that's the only way it can work. To form whatever governance structure that they would want to do. And the process that the coalition is now beginning is first to educate, and that's going on at home. And then, at the time we elect delegates, then delegates then would deal with the various structures of governance and decide which ones they're going to adopt. That takes it to the referendum. So, just going to role in it is to provide the resources that the coalition needs to get it going. This is like the third or fourth time we're trying, but we've got to get it done. Otherwise, it'll be an open wound that we'll be here forever. So we need to solve it, and the hope that this process will
do. Just to follow up on that, wasn't the earliest date for a possible convention to be like next month?
Yeah, then, the trustees, some of the trustees have issues about speeding it up. Right. And I think it's going to roll with training. I think no matter what deadline we set, the process will determine the time.
Well, that's what I was just trying to infer from the question, because you say, who's making this decision? I was trying to point out that it was one time next month.
Yeah.
Got pushed back.
So it moved to June, and I don't think they'll do it by June either next year. Who knows? So, and it's going to be beyond June, I'm sure.
But you participate in the process.
Yeah. The whole idea is to give as many people to participate in the process. A lot of people had problems with Kanaioloha. And Kanaioloha is like a voting list. Because in order for you to participate, we need to tell you what's going on so you can come to the party. But if you don't sign up, we don't know who you are, where you are. We can't talk to you about it. So you'll never get your views heard. So if you haven't signed up yet, sign up. If you want to take your name off the list, you can take it off the list. That'd be a good mistake. Okay.
Trustee Stender decided not to run again for Ohio. I want to acknowledge him and Buddy Butter.
Okay, so I might share with you folks what I know about this, the OHA, and where we are with OHA. So as you folks know, we've had some attempts, as Trustee Stender has indicated in the past, you know, to bring our people together to form a governance. You know, the difference with this one, this time, is the trustees have decided to step back and allow this to be a people process. So what does that mean? Some of us who belong to different organizations, we cannot have, 500,000 or so Hawaiians all at the table, right? So there are some organizations that will probably be, or if not already participating, on, I'm going to call it a working group. Some people call it a consortium, some people refer to it as a coalition. But they're really a working group. And it's not limited to just the initial working groups, because I've seen some of the proposals where others, you know, would be invited to the table. The initial people that I understand are there because they all have experiences with organizing conventions. So like the association, this is our 50-something convention, and you know what it takes to put a convention together. But it's not with a predetermined outcome, meaning that they're not going to influence whether it would be federal recognition, international, whatever. They are there to build the process to get us together to have that great debate to form that constitution. Okay, so that's why many of us encourage us to sign up so that we can get on to that great debate, so that we can get there. So what OHA's doing, from what I understand, and Trustee can tell me if I'm wrong, is they are going to be the resource people, the funders. So you know when you ask the question, I think Major G asked the question about the referendum. Maybe could we have a referendum first to decide which form of governance and then to go to the constitution step. Okay. So as Mahela said, this working group, and I'm going to call it by the people, for the people, would likely make that decision, yeah. And obviously they'll put it by OHA, who's the funder, and see whether OHA would agree or not. But if we truly believe that to make this happen, this has to be by all of us being at the table, then they're saying this time around that yes, we're going to empower the voices of the people. So, okay, and then one last thing I want to say, because for me, I've been in sessions where I have been attacked, I have been criticized and all. But you know why I hang in? Because it's important that all of our views be heard. So I will sit there and respectfully listen to other people's views, but they might change my mind. Just as if I'm there and I express my views, they don't have to accept it, but you know what? They'll go home and think about it. And that's the idea. We all got to come together, and I use this word, ho'omanawanui, which is patience, right? We have to have the patience to sit together and allow for the diverse viewpoints to be expressed, because diversity strengthens us, and we'll make sure that whatever decision we make is going to be the right decision. Okay, hala.
Is that already in place?
Okay. So,
where are we at with that?
Okay. So, I believe that at our board meeting, the association board meeting this afternoon, I think someone from OHA is going to come to give us an update. There have been various changes. I do know that one consortium that was considered, and I think some people already invited, was a consortium of those organizations who could trace their founding to an alumni. So the Rose Societies, association can trace their lineage to Bruce Cundillo. The Shaw can trace their lineage to Bruce Cundillo, and then whomever else. So there's been that. You may also have heard about a grants and aid application by the association CNHA and Shaw, and how that came about. It has to do really with the skills that those organizations bring, their experience in organizing a convention. Again, I'm unfortunate about this, but perception, I'm sure, by many is that, look at that, they're all three organizations who are for federal recognition. Okay? So, just speaking for me, I think what I would refer is those three, because they have the experience, but maybe add like Henry Noah's group or Bumpy's group, because they've also held conventions. They also held conventions. So that, you know, if all of these people come with their knowledge and skills, they can all contribute to the process of getting our people together in a constitutional convention, not with any predetermined outcome. In the meantime, while we're waiting, though, as Trustee Stender has indicated, while we're waiting for that, we're going through an education process. So for the association, this is an example. This is in the workshop this morning, and we're going to continue that. Hopefully we'll continue that and reach out to everyone to bring the education.
So there isn't an official working group established yet. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm just
at the meeting and in talking about it, but for this purpose, moving forward, is that what you would already expect?
I don't think it's being organized right now.
It's exciting to participate in that.
So she's asking, is there a working group already appointed, and are they already working?
Yeah.
And who makes up that group?
Besides the composition of that group.
Yeah, it's made up of a number of people in the Hawaiian community, mostly from the Lady Trust, mostly. And they, of course, are kind of walking through this thing. It's number four. And so they want to walk through the education piece first, to brief everyone as to what this whole thing is all about in the process, and then ask people to nominate delegates that would then kind of work out the little details. And you need to be involved each way, every step of the way.
I would say that if you are a member of the group and are interested in participating in this working group session, Sean will be coming out and giving you a person to come in. He's the administrator, so he's implementing.
And of course, they start this education process. Unfortunately, there's one that's happening on Saturday in high school. That unfortunately, they kind of mixed up. But it's looking at the list of people that will be there to give information. If you are going to be a model, you should go to this. Or if you are not, have friends or family to go, so that you would learn from these folks the various options before you, and their own experiences out there. Yeah, no, they don't have a civil union because I don't know what it was. What's the name of the lawyer?
I'm not quite sure, but I thought I heard. Is it Charles Town?
I never heard of these people before, but that might be a good thing. They're all supposed to be legal experts in governance.
International.
It's going to be live streamed.
Yes.
Yeah, live streamed, yes. So, I think
Casino had any.
It's all yours, huh? It's all yours.
All I know is that we don't have anyone in the kind of knowledge world that has what you have is international and those who are talking. Why is that?
We did not organize that.
Can you repeat the question?
That's a question to ask.
Yeah.
And
it could be that the administrator of Ohio has made very diligent efforts to give opportunities to people like on the side and to go out and do education. I think he has given that, and so they're bringing in other legal experts, because it's not intended to be a debate. It's supposed to be just presenting information. But I cannot speak for the organizer of the symposium.
I can give some insight, because I've asked some questions about that in terms of how this came about. And so educational symposium that's being held on Saturday is in response to a former Kamau Aguirre session where those who attended asked for this kind of presentation. So you get the experts in who have a lot of experience with that to speak to us. This is just one of many other forums that I'm sure will be held. But in this one, it's bringing in the experts from the international level, from the federal level, to be able to, share their experiences, answer any questions, and that it came about in response to our own people asking for this forum.
And so, is anyone of those very familiar with Kingdom Law?
I'm not quite sure that was the purpose of the. You don't get the purpose of the educational forum. It was to address from the international level and from the federal level what it means to have federal recognition. I'm supposing what the processes might be. It was not specific to addressing Hawaiian Kingdom laws. I don't believe so. So that could be another forum, because we've got people in Hawaii who are quite capable of doing that, and who in fact are. Because if you even go on the website, every so often I go and Google, and I get all these YouTube presentations. It's wonderful. I've heard a lot of presentations from Kim Tsai. I've heard presentations from Dr. Melody McKenzie. Just for men, Liliana Trask, you go there. There's still a lot out there.
I know that there's, that's why you're having this consortium of educational program that you're putting out on the first. But it's really interesting that you said federal and
And, you know, we're not talking federal level. We're talking international. As we're talking about, we are a sovereign nation. And that the one kingdom laws still exist.
So,
as that needs to be talked about. And I just, you know, question, what can these speakers talk to us about Hawaii kingdom law, and does it exist, and if so, how does it work out in an international level? Because that's very important to us.
So I will just say that their comments are needed because we can't answer the question because we weren't responsible for that. I just wanted to share with you though how it came about, and it was in response to Native Hawaiians who participated in Kamauea who asked for this kind of educational symposium. I think we wanted to move to looking at what, or to talk about what an indigenous constitution might look like, because we gave you an idea of what the constitutions of the 1800s looked like. But what might a constitution of, what are we, 2015 look like that we put together as Native Hawaiian people? So I think Mahialani is just going to talk maybe on just a couple of provisions for an indigenous constitution.
In response to that last question about using an expert in international law, I see a website here. We have Jim Anaya, who's an expert in international human rights. He's been around Hawaii a couple times. There's Francis Boyle, who's taught in the area of international law and human rights. This guy named Maury Mike Sue, who was an advisor, is it a professor of international law at the University of Tartu, and is an advisor to the Chancellor of the Justice of the Republic of Estonia. So there's some broad range of international experts there as well.
Whenever people talk about we're under Hawaiian kingdom law, which one is that? The constitution that Val went over?
That constitution was 1887.
1887.
Yes.
But people who say we're under that law now is referring to the Constitution of
1887. Actually, I think they're saying that the Constitution that was refused, the one that we believe proposed, her process was awarded, but they would say that that is the Constitution, which is basically the Constitution of 1864.
1864.
Yes. I think she was really trying to reinstate the Constitution of 1864.
Okay, and so in this Constitution of 1864, Alan, was there a one that said non-Hawaiians could be a member of the kingdom?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
If you could, we have a document called Paukalani Declaration. Would you mind turning to it? It's a colored one. And I think Mobi just wanted to give us a flavor of possibilities of an indigenous constitution. So I thought if we could read along in the preamble, which is on the first, actually the second page that has words on it. And I just thought if you could just read along with us, and it's so exciting because these were our own Kanaka who wrote this together. So I'll just begin reading, and if you could read along. Inspired by this historical meeting at Paokalani upon the lands of our Queen Liliuokalani, Kalanis, we celebrate the mana of our Akua, Aumakua, Kupuna, Aina, and Lawe. Cognizant of our Kuleana and guardians of our culture and land, we endorse the following declaration as our collective responsibility to determine a common future for Hawaii, her culture, and indigenous people. Throughout the Pacific Basin and Kapa'aina Hawaii, the territories, lands, submerged lands, marine resources, and seas of our peoples are being subjected to commercial exploitation. This exploitation is perpetuated by state and national governments, international agencies, private corporations, academic institutions, and associated research corporations. Commercialization has profoundly and adversely impacted Kanaka Maoli spiritual practices, sacred sites, and associated objects, preventing our ceremonial undertakings, encouraging the selling of sacred ceremonial artifacts, and advertising the images of sacred ceremony in Kalaimana. The creative cultural expressions of Kanaka Maoli are being stolen and commercialized for the advertising of commercial products and for sale of our lands and natural resources, in total disregard for and in derogation of our rights as creators of these artistic cultural expressions. And on and on and on. That's just a flavor. It's a recitation in a sense of certain grievances, and it talks about at least their sense of where we're at as a people today. And then it goes on to talk about the ways in which we can collectively address these concerns. And so, this was written in 2003. And I know that at least at that time, there was a great concern about the misappropriation of things that belong to us as a people and a culture. So, this is a time when we had people coming forward who were very interested in patenting our genetic material. People who were, for example, I know that, for example, Kalo farmers at the University of Hawaii, they were hybridizing new breeds and then patenting the Hawaii Kalo. And then developing certain disease-resistant varieties and then making them available to our cattle farmers only for a price. These kinds of things were occurring. So this conference was in part, I think, a response to that sort of misappropriation of things that really belong to us as Kanaka. So, reading every single word here, we really want to recommend that take the time and read through this beautiful document as an expression of our understanding of where we are today as a people and what our dreams and aspirations are to address these issues. Is there one to do this?
I have a question. Yes. Time we just read. Is there, does Oma have any involvement in such commercial land?
My first trustee is here, but I would say this, that Oahu receives revenues derived from the lands that were stolen, which are now managed by the state of Hawaii. To the extent that those lands are being utilized for any purpose that you're describing, it's possible that Oahu is party in a vicariously, indirectly, because the state of Hawaii may be engaging in those types of activities that we find objectionable. That's a possibility. Now, the most recent issue that has come on is this acquisition of Kaka'ako Makai. Now, Oha, as I understand it, acquired that land with the expectation that it would generate revenues for Oha's beneficiaries. But that is not a settled question. It's still developing its master plan for the area. So that is not, that is, that mine is there area under OMA's management. But the other is managed by the state and OMA derives some revenue from it.
Yeah. Actually, the problem is not just only as to what the land issue is. And it was in the 1950s when oil became a state venue, right? The Organic Act created the state in that transition of the federal government, transition over to the state of Hawaii, 1.2 million acres of land, which is part of the land that was ceded to First Republic and then to the United States in 1898. So at that time it was 1.8 million acres. So what was returned to the state was 1.2. So the missing 600,000 acres, 200,000 is one homes. And then the rest of it is for property, all military. So, in that transition and return of those lands, what the Organic Act said, that these lands are to be used to benefit five purposes. And for the betterment of Hawaiians is one of the five purposes. So we at OPA interpret that to mean 20% of the revenues from these lands belong to OPA. And fighting over it since all was created, and we continue to negotiate settlement of that issue. The $200 million Takaka property that Hoa got in settlement was only for the difference of what Hoa was being paid and what, as against what was proved. And that number was arrived at by arbitration. We have a higher number. So that settles that part of it. Only the difference between those. So it's still a lot more that we need to negotiate and settle with the state. One is the airport land fees. Landing fees is a lot of money, and the state refused to pay us for that because they said they have an agreement with the federal government that says they don't have to pay them, and that's not so. So we've got to completely fight that battle, and then the rest of it, keep auditing what the state is getting on these lands. We have to audit it every day.
Otherwise, we would never get one. Aloha, my name is Nikki Boyer, and I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I love constitutional law, and I'd like to impress upon everyone the comments that were made by Mahia and Alan. And that is that what's really beautiful, and as well as, you know, what's really beautiful about us as Hawaiians putting our own monopoly in the Constitution is that we don't have to, you know, Alan was talking about all the previous constitutions that were put forth, 1840 or 1816. 1867. And those constitutions, which actually all made by non-Hawaiians for the most part. So what's really important is, and I like what you said about the 2003 constitution proposed, because when we get together, we get things like, hey, you know what? We want in our constitution that we have a consul. Because that way we can connect up with our elders, you know, and get their manawa. And we can put that in our constitution. We can do a lot of great things for our people. And that's what's exciting about where we are at this time. My question to you, Alan, is, can I remember? Oh, I went off to
too much.
You have a poop in the moment.
I have enough poop in the moment. The question was, I think I'll get back to you and get to the next question. When I sit down, it'll come to me. It was really important. Oh, I was going to ask you. Alan, where does it say between the agreement between the Hawaiians and the state of Hawaii and the federal government, where does it say that at such time when the Hawaiians formed their own nation, that all the assets of OHA will go into the new nation? Where does it say that? Because JWIA keeps telling us that. When a nation is formed, the act is by law is supposed to move into the Hawaiian nation. Where does it say that? Is it in the law somewhere?
I don't think there's anything formal that says that the assets of OHA would. There's some language in the Waikele Ohuna acquisition, and the Olave legislation suggests that in line. But
I think it's something to do with the 1978 convention, where it says during when OHA was created, I think that's what it, am I right, Mahia?
It would be more likely than legislated.
It's not stated in the statutes.
Oh, it's not. Okay, well, it would be interesting to review the legislative history to see where they were kind of ground understanding. Thank you very much, all of you.
Lama is one of those who are not living currently in the state of Hawaii, but my heart is here. What I would like to know is, what is your definition of a nation within a nation? Does that word mean to you or to us that we will be a nation under another nation? Or will we be an independent nation dealing internationally with all the governments throughout the world? And if so, is it inclusive? Because this whole document has to do with lands, the unrightful ruling, making things right, looking for those areas where the aina is now ours. But I look at the state of Hawaii today, it is ours, but more than ours. We have a people who live here that are not Hawaiians. I'm saying this very tenderly. What becomes of us or them that live here, that have given themselves solely to the our Hawaii? Do they have a chance to vote in this alliance that is now being built, the referendum, the constitution, the formation of this government? Will they be participating and have the right to vote? These are fundamentals, because as a person, I want to know if I was a pure Hawaii. I'm living here. Well, how am I going to be affected? If I have a dad from the Philippine Islands who is not a citizen yet, wow, where shall we be? These are things that, what is Hawaiiana? We need to think of all those who are not part of the indigenous people. They make up a large portion of our Hawaii. So I just raise the question. When you say, what is your definition of a nation within a nation? Or is it a nation rising up to be a nation? Independent, with justice and peace, and hope for a future that not only means for us as Hawaiians, but everyone who lives in, I have to say, the state of Hawaii right now.
What is being attempted now is an indigenous nation. And if, as an indigenous people, we agree that we want independence, and if, as an indigenous people, we agree that we want to claim the entire Kaiana, which constitutes Hawaii, It will be necessary to engage every single person who wishes to reside within the pipeline to participate in the decision. Period. So that means that 4/5 of our residents were not participating in this current effort, and then it would have to be engaged. We're not going to have only how long is. I think we're out of time, but we want to thank all of you. It's been a really interesting. Oh, please take just 1 minute to fill out the evaluation. It would be really, really helpful, especially for us to plan future workshops in our community, which we think are really important.
So you know who Betty is?
Yes, yes. This is yours.
I get on board.